Hello and welcome to this special edition of the camera podcast Pubs, Pints, People. I'm Claire Phillips and with me as ever are Alison Tafts and Simon Webster. Last week we were at Olympia for the 2023 Great British Beer Festival and hopefully we gave you a flavour of what was going on, albeit not in the same way as if you'd been there with a glass of beer in your hand. We have some more full interviews that we recorded for the GBBF special. We didn't want to shorten them to squeeze them into an already packed podcast, so we've split our GBBF special into two parts, and this is part two.
There were several books launched at GBBF, and we spoke with Des Damour about his new book, Cask, and also with Adam Wells about his new book, All About Perry, which is planned to be published early next year.
We also hear from Pete Brown about the Drink Cask Fresh campaign that he's been closely involved with. Before the beer festival, Alison spoke with Des Damour about his new book, Cask.
Des, I know you, like me, and so many of our listeners are deeply passionate about Cask. So tell us about this new book.
So this book is called Cask, simply, and the subtitle is The Real Story of Britain's Unique Beer Culture. And I think that kind of, you know, captures some of what's, you know, the book is trying to do. So it's really trying to tell the story in depth about Cask. It's explaining what Cask is, how it's made, how it's particularly how it's kind of served and conditioned in the cellar and all those kinds of things. So it goes into to detail about that, but in a non-technical way. It's not written for for brewers or for cellar keepers or whatever. It's written for kind of interested drinkers. And then it continues through the history of cask as well, because I think, again, that's something that's quite misunderstood, going right back to the beginnings of brewing and right through to the present day. And then the final chapter is about the future of cask, where, you know, as I'm sure most people listening to this will realise, there are some challenges with cask beer. So what are those challenges? What can we do about them? And what kind of future does cask have? So it's trying to tell that whole story. And particularly in this context of saying, you know, Britain's unique beer culture, because I think the other thing about cask is it's one of those things that's, I mean, there are tiny, tiny pockets of it in other places, and I cover some of that in the book. So I talk to some people who make cask in the United States and in Canada and in Ireland, and I also know there's other people in places like Italy and Scandinavia doing it, but it's a really, really tiny scale, whereas in this country, still, just about, you know, it's something that's still a to some extent a mass market product. You can, you know, expect to walk in, find at least some pubs in most places where you might find a hand pump on the bar. That is really special, because cask does something really special as well. That's another thing that the book goes into. What is it that sets cask apart? Why is it important? And not just in terms of saying, well, you know, it's heritage and that kind of thing, but also what effect does it have in the here and now in terms of, like, you know, the flavour and of the beer and the enjoyment of drinking it. And I really just, you know, try and make the case for cask. It's really interesting. I don't think anyone's done a book like this before. I've certainly not come across anything. And I suppose the other thing to say is that the book tries to challenge some of the myths as well, because that's the other thing, all the kind of conversations that have been generated about cask over many, many decades, starting at a time when the people who drank it and enjoyed it really didn't know very much about the technical side of it, and when the sort of knowledge of brewing and beer was sort of far lower than it is today. There's a lot of myths been perpetuated about it, and I think this is the other thing that the book tries to do. It tries to, you know, tell the real story, as I say in the title.
It sounds amazing, incredibly comprehensive. I absolutely cannot wait to get my hands on my copy. Okay. What made you decide, Des, to sort of write this book right now?
Well, just really partly because there was a gap there. You know, I saw that there was that gap, and I was one of those people who, you know, constantly found myself confronting some of these myths about cask. I suppose the germ of it was in that period back in the, you know, the last decade. There was a sort of period when craft beer was really emerging and the craft beer movement was emerging. We were starting to see on a widespread scale for the first time in British pubs some really, really good and flavoursome keg beers, and then bottled and increasingly canned beers starting to emerge, beers that weren't cask but were still, you know, very full of flavour and obviously very well made and so on. And of course that sparked off a huge debate, some of which was quite misinformed on both sides, and I was quite frustrated with that at the time. I started to kind of think my way through. So I started actually to write what I thought was going to be a little mini book at the time, which was originally called Real Ale and Reality. It kind of, you know, other things sort of took over. But then I came back to the idea, and somebody said to me, well, you really should put it to camera books, because, you know, there was a time when they would have been the last people I'd go to about it, I have to say. But cameras changed over the past few years. It's finally kind of caught up with those changes, and it's kind of looked at things around its definition of cask and its definition of live beer, and started to engage with things like key kegs and so on. So, you know, there has been a big change blowing through, and I think it was the, you know, the right time to do that kind of book with camera books, but also the right time to do the book with an increasing number of people who are now coming into beer and, like, you know, really, really getting enthusiastic and motivated about beer. They're people I meet through the other work I do, so all the kind of tutor tastings and beer tours and things that I do, who don't necessarily come to it through that cask route, so they haven't really engaged with cask. And I suppose it's also trying to write something for them and tell them why cask is important, and particularly addressing the fact, which it's another point the book makes, we have to face the fact now that, yes, it is still fairly widely available, certainly compared to other countries, but it's a niche product now. The latest statistics that I have show that, you know, if you look at the proportion of beer produced in the UK, cask only accounts for about 4.2% of it. It's a very, very small amount of output from breweries. That's still quite a lot of beer, but it's much, much less than if you look back to, say, the beginning of the 20th century, when cask was pretty much accounting for well over 90% of the output of British breweries. So, you know, its position in the market has changed hugely, and I think we need to accept that. We need to accept that it's now a niche product, and we need to kind of, you know, sell it on that basis and attract people to it on that basis, rather than trying to pretend it's still, you know, the drink of the average working man, which it clearly isn't.
That's quite a statistic. That's quite sobering, if that's a good choice of word, isn't it? But yes, I think there's something really, really interesting there about that idea of it being a specialist product. Yeah. So what are your thoughts, having gone through this obviously very comprehensive process, Des, and get your words onto the page, what are your thoughts now about the future of cask?
I think if we accept that fact and we focus on, you know, making it a kind of quality premium product and focusing on what makes it different, and not just in terms of its heritage, because I don't think that engages everybody. Saying something is kind of, you know, part of our heritage and tradition isn't necessarily a way of engaging people who don't aren't necessarily familiar with that heritage and tradition. I think we also need to focus on the effect that serving cask beer at a slightly lower carbonation, a slightly kind of warmer temperature than keg beer has on the flavour of it, and on the mouthfeel and the kind of perception that we get of the flavours and aromas that way, in a way that we won't get through any other way, which works so well with those kind of traditional British beer styles. And I think we focus on that, and the, you know, keeping it the highest possible quality and positioning it as a specialist product, then it's got a chance. But it also has to pay for itself, and I think this is the other thing where I might part ways with a few keen cask drinkers, is we have to recognise it's underpriced. You know, it's often the cheapest thing on the bar, and it's actually, you know, the specialist product that's the most involved in terms of making it, looking after it. It's got a very short shelf life. You know, it's an average of kind of 3 days. Once you start emptying a cask, you've got to sell it before its quality drops below a certain level that it's not worth drinking. And with all those problems, it's ridiculous that we're paying, you know, people expect to pay less for it than they expect to pay for a standard industrial lager from a multinational with all their economies of scale. I think we need to face that too. And if we can keep that going as a real kind of quality product, as a real kind of beacon of something, you know, really special that beer can do in a way that other drinks can't, we're in with a chance, because we're in with the fact that it might build up again, and it might build up to the extent that people will sustain it, and they'll start to see it in the same bracket as perhaps they see other products, they, you know, beer products that they are more readily recognised as like artisanal in some way, like kind of you know, modern style craft beers and mixed fermentation beers and things like that. I make the comparison in the book between cask and lambic. Cask, if you look internationally, cask is kind of recognised in the same bracket. If you talk to a lot of brewers outside the UK, you know, they're absolutely fascinated by it, in the same way that they're fascinated by wild fermentation and mixed fermentation beers. Those are recognised as specialist artisanal product. You know, we need to get cask into that same bracket and sustain it that way, I think.
Yes, I think that's inspired, actually, that combination of things like lambic beers and cask. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we're in this country, we're probably too close to it to see it in quite that way. And I obviously thoroughly agree with your feelings on the underpriced nature of cask. It really is a problem.
Yeah.
And I do understand cost pressures and people wanting to get a pint at value. But equally, as you say, cask really ought to be a more expensive representative on the bar.
Yeah, I think the other important point to talk about price is the price differential side. But there's also this kind of expectation that if your cask beer is at a certain ABV, then it should cost a certain amount, regardless of where it comes from, how it's made, what the ingredients are, what the style is, how many or how few hops have gone into it or whatever. You know, if it's 4% ABV, we will pay this much per firkin. If it's 4.5, we will pay this much. And you can't think of any other product where that is the case, where people kind of don't expect that the quality and the provenance and things like that shouldn't play a role. You know, it's like the idea that you could expect a bottle of sort of bog standard plonk to cost exactly the same as a Grand Cru Classe Bordeaux on the grounds that they're both 13.5%. You know, it's ludicrous. And I think that would be a good start to actually start to see differentials in price, and that, you know, some casks cost more than others, and it's not just because of their strength.
Absolutely. And thinking about taking on what you're talking about, there's obviously some of these things that we're discussing here are going to be of great interest to camera members and beer lovers listening to this podcast. So what kind of thing can we do to help assure Cask Ale's future right now?
Drink it. I think, you know, drink it and buy it. But also, you know, drink good quality cask. You know, seek out good quality cask and send out that message that what really matters with cask is that quality. You know, be discriminating about it. And also be critical about it, the average quality of cask, and that it's not quite as good as it ought to be, partly because of the way it's looked after and partly because places try to do too much and that when they don't have the turnover. If we're a little bit more upfront, in a polite way of, like, you know, sort of highlighting that a little bit, it wouldn't do any harm. All the surveys find that if somebody goes into a pub, buys a pint of cask and it's a bit flat and it's a bit vinegary and not very nice, then they're not so likely to complain about it. They're just likely to walk out the door and not come back again. So that doesn't necessarily get registered that there's a problem there. So, you know, if you are kind of up to very politely, you know, suggesting there might be something wrong with it, you know, that I think that helps too, just to raise that issue with people.
I'm into that, Des, and definitely obviously we've got the national beer scoring option as well for those people who enjoy doing that. That's something, a nice way to contribute in terms of the good beer guide and things like that.
Yeah. So definitely. When we were writing the book, I met up with a cask mark assessor to talk about kind of assessing cellars, and we went in a pub in central London, and I wasn't drinking because I had lots of other calls to make that day, but he ordered a pint of cask, and lo and behold, we were there to talk about cask quality, and there was this horrible dirty greasy gas with, like, you know, no head, and the cask was vinegary and flat and too warm, and all the problems that we were going to talk about. And I thought, this is absolutely perfect that this has happened just now, you know.
The perfect example. Yeah. It's clear to me that we just need to keep focusing on those two simple things. Keep drinking cask, keep looking for the good stuff, and tell people when it's not right.
Yes.
Celebrated beer writer Pete Brown has been working for the last 6 months on the cross-industry Drink Cask Fresh campaign, which aims to make cask ale more relevant to a younger audience who may only drink it occasionally. Pete says the research reveals that there are no deeply held prejudices against cask ale amongst younger drinkers, but there are ways that the industry can work together to promote the visibility and relevance of cask as a whole to everybody's benefit.
I'm delighted to be talking to you about a subject very close to my, your and camera's heart, drinking cask fresh.
Absolutely, yeah. close to all our hearts.
So tell us a little bit, for those who haven't heard of it, I don't know where they've been, but they might have missed it. So give us a little outline of what the campaign's been about.
There are a lot of industry bodies that are interested in cask, both from a commercial point of view and, more than that, most people are involved in it from a very personal point of view as well. And cask ale is not doing very well at the moment. The market is about half of where it was 10 years ago. And there's been a lot of meetings and cask reports and things like that, trying to kind of put out some positive messages about cask. I wrote the first cask report about 16 years ago, I think. And obviously, it hasn't sort of changed the direction. And so people from Camera and Ciba about a year ago had this idea to do a consumer-facing campaign about Cask to try and get it noticed again. So there was a lot of research into how you might engage people. You know, the Cask drinker's aging. I think a lot of people can go into good cask pubs and see a lot of cask ale being sold, but it's not recruiting the younger drinkers that it needs to kind of stay where it is. And so the campaign is all about, what can you say to younger drinkers? Might be different from what the older drinker loves about cask, but what can you do to engage these people who are currently not really engaging with it?
Yeah, and I think this angle that you've talked about have been focused in on sort of challenging perhaps some of those misconceptions. And I know that you've picked up on a couple of key points that people are interested in hearing about before they choose a drink at the bar.
Yeah, it's a funny one, because what you get in the industry talking shops, in the groups where we all sit around, people say, oh yeah, cask, it's just beardy old men in socks and sandals and stuff like that. I've never, ever heard that played back by a consumer from outside the industry. That's something we just tell ourselves, and we're talking it down. What you do get from consumers is cask, oh, it's don't know much about it, don't really think about it, it's a bit warm, isn't it? It's a bit strong, it's always dark. You know, it's things like that. So we wanted to kind of challenge some of those. It's more about the products than the image of it. And people just don't know enough about it. So we wanted to kind of start talking about it in ways that might be relevant to people. And there's a lot of different things you could say about cask. People like the fact that it's local. They think that it's made on a smaller scale. There's more artisanship to it. They actually kind of quite like the tradition and the history aspect to it. But we sort of zoomed in on this idea that because in a good cask pub, the beer is only on the bar for 3 days, that cask ale is actually the freshest beer on the bar. You know, if it's not sold in 3 days, in theory, it should go. And freshness is important to people. It's something they expect from their beer. They expect it to be fresh. So we thought that might be an interesting way of changing how people think about cask.
Yeah, I mean, certainly since, you know, that I read about that, we've changed the header. In my pub, we are very cask-driven, and I've started writing fresh cask ale, whereas before I used to write cask ale, now I write fresh cask ale, yeah. And I find myself using that term, and it definitely does chime with people, the idea. And I think people really don't realise that cask is as ephemeral as it is. It comes and then it needs to go. But in that is the joy of that freshness and that sort of living in the moment idea. So I really think it taps in well to people's focus on that. So overall, what has the campaign been trying to do? How has it been reaching out to these potential consumers?
So what we did, this has been very much a pilot stage to see how it works and to see what we can learn about it. So the idea is that what we learn from the pilot, we then put into rolling it out a bit more broadly in the future. And so what we did, it was very much a kind of controlled experiment. We had 27 pubs that we ran a campaign in, and each one of those pubs was paired up with a pub that was very similar in terms of how big it was, how much cask it sold and that kind of thing. And so we got two pubs. And one's got the campaign material in it, the other one doesn't. And apart from that, they're very, very similar. So 27 pairs of those. And we ran that for 10 weeks from March to May. We talked to the staff. We had WhatsApp groups with the staff in the trial pubs. We did some focus group research in them. And we monitored the sales data to compare the pilot pub with the control pub all over 10 weeks. So we learned a hell of a lot about how the campaign actually worked.
I know that you are planning on the Tuesday of GBBF to give the sort of full results. But can you give us a sneak peek as to what the results have been?
I mean, We were looking at it in terms of what we want to do with people is get them to notice cask, then get them talking about it and asking questions about it, and then hopefully buy more of it. We definitely succeeded in making cask more noticeable. We definitely succeeded in getting more conversation around it. It's inconclusive as to whether that kind of went through into sales. In some pubs, cask sales absolutely rocketed. In others, they didn't. And there's so many different factors feeding into that. The weather, whether you're a university pub and the students home halfway through the trial, pubs where cask went up really well, but it went up even higher in the control pub, and then you find out that the control pub had a wedding reception on where the groom and all his mates drank cask, you know. So there's all these different factors. What we definitely did, we gave cask the higher profile that it needs. And more than that, we learned in a bit more detail about what some of the issues around it are. Things that were kind of in plain sight, but we hadn't really noticed or thought about before. So, for example, cask is now the only beer that when it's poured from the pump, it's below the bar. So even when you get a pint of Guinness now, you can actually see the pint being poured. It's above the bar. It's in your eye line. And you order a pint of cask, and the you can't see what they're doing below the bar, and then out comes this pint of beer. And people are a bit trepidatious about that. The other thing is that we did this one piece of promotional material, and we just put different colours, beers of different colours. We put a blonde ale in, a best bitter, and a porter. And people looked at that and went, wow, I didn't know it came in all those different colours. Wow, that's really interesting. That isn't even what we were trying to research. We had some slogans on top of these pieces of paper. They weren't even looking at the slogans. They were looking at the different colours of the beer. So it's like, oh, right, so the way it looks and how it's presented is really, really important. And there's a lot of stuff that, if you look at the success of things like Mediterranean Lager, we could slag them off and say the product's awful to our heart's content. It doesn't change the fact that it's growing way, way faster than cask is. And when you look at what they're doing right, the glassware, the presentation, the pour being in your eye line, knowing what to expect. So there's a lot to think about for the industry. And I think we learned that there's only so much an individual brand can do. You know, if you look at a good cask pub, there's no point trying to have individual branded glassware, because if you've got a lot of guest ales, they're changing every couple of days. So you can't possibly have all the glassware you need. So having a cask branded glass, that went down really, really well. If we're serving cask ale, we're serving it in a cask fresh glass, whatever the brand of cask ale is. So there's a lot of stuff that we need to kind of now feedback into the industry and ask them to think about.
That visual thing is such a draw for people. And it's so interesting that, as you were saying, it never occurred to me that, of course, it's buried under the bar and people don't see the colour and they don't see the pour. So, yeah, the visual thing clearly is a big learning for us. In terms of the types of beer being drunk, was that changed by the campaign at all, or was it broadly across the board of these different styles?
I think we tried analysing sales data by brand and splitting it by guest and regular, and we'd still be here in 5 years' time if I tried to kind of do it that way. So we had to go for the total numbers. It's a really complicated exercise. But what we did see from that thing with the different colours is that there's a lot of people who drink cask very, very occasionally, who immediately said, well, I'd drink it a lot more if I knew that I could get a pale one like that, because that's not too far away from lager. So the fact that there's so many different styles, on the one hand, it's confusing for people because they don't really know where to start. On the other hand, if they get a bit more navigation around it, if they're a bit more confident around it, then it's a massive source of cask's appeal.
And do you think with all of this focus and attention of the campaign, perhaps people were giving out more tasters? Because that's something I feel is a really powerful tool that we have, where pubs give tasters to people. And suddenly when you're tasting it, it's a completely different experience.
Yeah, I mean, we always encourage that. And one factor that you get with running a promotion like this is that in the pubs where they're going, yeah, brilliant, we're going to really get behind this, and we're going to get the staff to talk to people about it, and we're going to offer samples. Guess what? It did a lot better than in the pubs where people just went, all right, then we'll put your leaflets out and leave it at that. So the more the staff are engaged, I mean, every single piece of research I've ever seen says that staff recommendation is one of the biggest things that drives people's choice of what they're going to drink if they haven't already decided. And so if you get some passionate pro-cask bar staff giving out samples, talking about the beers, then you're going to sell more cask. It's as simple as that.
So perhaps that's the key to our focus area is employer and employee engagement.
Yeah, totally. I sort of split it into three groups in my head now. There are lots and lots of pubs out there that are passionate about cask and they're selling loads of it. And if you're drinking in those pubs, you can go, well, what's the problem? This is fine. There's not much a campaign like this can do to help those pubs. They've got it. They're sorted. There's a whole other bunch of pubs where they're just not interested. And you know what? I'd rather they didn't sell cask than sell a bad pint of cask. And then in the middle, you've got these pubs that are kind of keen, interested, curious about cask, but just need a bit more push, a bit more help. And that's what a campaign can really do, is they're going, yeah, I'm curious about cask. How do I sell more of it? How do I learn more about it? And that's where we need to be focusing this as it goes forward, I think.
So really focusing in, zoning in on those areas where we can really make a difference.
Yeah.
So in terms of what came out of the exercise that you think are really the things that we should be doing differently in the future to make the best use of this research and work you've been doing?
There's so many different potential things you can say about cask. And there are certain things that appeal to some people and not to other people. So we put like these really kind of cool stemmed branded pint glasses in. And all the old regulars who were at the bar going, I don't want my beer in that. I want my old dimpled pint mug. That's horrible. That's rotten. And it's like, yeah, fine. Okay. We won't serve you the beer in the campaign glass. But then you give it to someone in their 30s who's choosing a pint of cask instead of a pint of lager. They think it looks really cool. So it's kind of zooming in on the people who are interested and getting the messages right to the people who are interested. So people who are hard camera fans, they love the fact that Cask Ale has secondary fermentation in the pub cellar and it's not finished until it's been properly vented and let to condition and settle for a few days. And that's one of the things that they like about it, the fact that it's still a live product. If you talk to kind of a more general drinker, that stuff can actually put them off. It sounds way too technical, way too boring. But if you tell them, well, it's made locally or it's the freshest beer on the bar, they go, oh, right, yeah, well, that's interesting. So it's about getting the right messages out to the right people and really thinking about how we talk about Cask. You've got so many different aspects of it to choose from to talk about, and it's matching the right message up with the right people.
There we go. I think that sounds like a brilliant conclusion to get the messaging right in the right places. And I guess it's the publican and his team are the best people to understand, you know, how to reach those
Absolutely.
Different audiences.
Definitely. Yeah.
Okay. So what do you think is going to happen next, Pete?
I've got to present the full results back to the industry, and then hopefully people will engage and say, okay, we're prepared to fund this campaign for the next stage, but we have to sit and with the learnings that we've got and decide what that next stage is going to be. But whether it's, I certainly hope that we see this campaign go forward, but whether it's this campaign or not, I think what we've proven is the need for a category campaign where the industry gets together and works with one voice is absolutely vital. So I hope that happens, and I hope that if it does, then it's behind this campaign.
Is there any way that we can see the results? Obviously, the website that you've created, the Drink Cask Fresh website, is that staying in situ for the time being?
I certainly hope so.
Yeah, it's a really useful resource. Yeah.
Yeah. These things obviously all cost money, so it's all about people deciding to carry on giving us their generous support.
I would encourage anyone who hasn't been to the Drink Cask Fresh website to take a look because it's very concise, very clearly presented. It's got lovely glossaries and information providing support for publicans, for drinkers alike. So, yeah, really useful tool, I think. And hopefully that kind of a clear communication can help cut through with some folks, as you say, some different audiences that would be interested to stumble upon it or go and find it. So fantastic. And in terms of the findings, those of us who aren't able to make your session where you're feeding back your findings in a bit more detail, where can we go to follow up on that?
I would suggest the Drink Cask Fresh website is a good place to start, but we will be publicising them quite heavily through camera, through SIBA, so hopefully it will appear in your inbox as well pretty soon.
Around the time of GBBF, Camera announced the upcoming release of its groundbreaking new Perry book from writer Adam Wells, which will be the first consumer guide to one of the UK's most traditional drinks. Despite being largely unknown outside of the UK, Perry has for centuries been compared to fine wine and champagne in countries all around the world. Although it's fallen out of fashion in recent years, it's making a comeback, with producers creating both new and traditional Perrys to great acclaim. Camera's championing of cider and perry at its festivals over the last 50 years has been credited with playing a significant role in keeping perry alive, and now the campaign is going further to promote and support this traditional drink. Penned by drinks writer, presenter and founder-editor of the popular Cider Review website, Adam Wells. As a perry advocate and lover, I am so delighted that Adam is writing this book. His passion for this drink is boundless, and his knowledge encyclopedic, as you will hear. I sat down and spoke with Adam at Olympia, as we were both volunteering on the Learning and Discover stand at GBBF, sharing tasters of perry with visitors, and he makes a deeply compelling case for this somewhat neglected delight. So, Adam, I know that you and I are both big perry devotees. You are the biggest perry devotee, and it's no surprise to me that you've chosen to write this amazing book. But when I explain what perry is to people quickly during service in the pub, I say perry is to pears as to cider is to apples. How would you describe it, Adam?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the best shorthand for it. It is just the equivalent of cider, but with pears, or indeed the equivalent of wine, but with pears. It is a fermented, not brewed, drink made out of a particular fruit, in this case, pears. Often very special and specific varieties of pears, which are grown specifically for no other purpose than perry. But of course, perry can be made from any sort of pears, and indeed is all around the world.
We do see perry in lots of different locations, don't we? And it's interesting to see your timing now to write this book. So tell us, first of all, what's going to be the title and when can we get our hands on this book?
So the title is a work in progress. It'll be something along the lines of The Drinker's Guide to Perry or The Camera Guide to Perry, but something that communicates that it is a guide specifically aimed at the drinker to this wonderful drink, which hasn't had its own book aimed at the drinker before. There's going to be a Kickstarter campaign in October, exactly the same idea as it was for Gabe's brilliant Modern British Cider a few years ago, and if that goes as we hope it will, then the book will be published in May next year.
Perfect, just in time for Cider and Perry Month, so that seems perfect timing. So what made you decide to write this book now?
If you look at the raw numbers of Perry in the UK, it looks like a drink that's in a really parlous state. They've dropped 47% in the last few years. But if you dig a little bit deeper, that mainly reflects the biggest commercial brands of Perry. So names that people might recognise, things like Baby Sham or indeed Copperberg Pear Cider. Because in the UK and in most countries, Pear Cider has exactly the same legal definition as Perry. It's just a different name. The question of whether it should be called Pear Cider or Perry is one that we'll address in the book. But to return to the initial point, what has also happened in the last few years as these big commercial brands have struggled is that aspirational Perrys have just started to really find their voice and do better and better. And by aspirational Perrys, I mean Perrys made with high juice content, not from concentrate, Perrys that look to hero these varieties, champion these incredible trees, some of which can live up to 300 years old, and Perrys made with the sensitivity and care of any of the great drinks in the world. You've got producers like Ross-on-Wye, Oliver's, Greg's Pitt, and many, many more making these wonderful, wonderful drinks and just getting better and better. And new makers are starting to approach Perry, places that have not previously perhaps been associated with Perry, like the United States and Australia, even Japan, are saying, hey, you know, there's this amazing drink to be made here. We're interested. And so the quality of Perry really hasn't been as high as it is now for centuries, potentially. And so it's an exciting time for Perry, and the more exciting it becomes, the more apparent it was that this guide for a drinker just wasn't there. And so we're looking to change that.
So you're filling that gap so we can find out more about this fascinating drink. And I noticed you mentioned there the history of Perry. And I know that, certainly from my reading, and I'm sure you'll mention this, it really does have a quite a noble history, doesn't it, in terms of the drinking past. Perry was seen as something really, really special, as we kind of feel it is today.
It was, absolutely. I mean, the first written mention of Perry goes all the way back to Pliny in the first century AD, where, in fact, in his first ever mention of a drink that we'd recognise as Perry, he's directly comparing it to wine. So it has been compared to other drinks for its entire recorded life. But yeah, in the UK, in the 17th century, you've got, at the same time as people were taking this real intellectual academic interest in cider, you have the same people studying Perry, considering varieties, looking at ways that they can make more interesting Perry in ways that kind of champion the fruit, and on an international level. You know, in the same decade as we start reading about Perry being taken more seriously in the UK, we have those same people saying, oh, and we've heard from makers and ambassadors in Switzerland that they have this incredible pear that actually makes what the UK pomologists were saying was the best Perry in the world. So it's always been international. And our recorded history of it in the UK is actually not as long as it is in countries like France and Austria. And so that's something that I'm really keen to kind of emphasize in the book. It shouldn't be an insular drink. It's an international drink that we're very, very lucky to still have in the UK, because some countries have this incredible Perry history and now it's all but gone. Switzerland, particularly, and Germany have clung on to it really by the skin of their teeth. It's only the UK and France and Austria that still have a really significant modern Perry culture. And it's just so rare and important. And I think it's very, you know, it's vital that history and that heritage, and particularly just this incredible flavorful drink, gets protected.
Many people listening to this will be camera members, will understand how important it is to hold on to those traditions. Aside from that, from a sort of pure enjoyment point of view, why should people seek out and try and drink Perry, Adam?
Well, first and foremost, just because, as you say, it's absolutely delicious. Second of all, because it's not a monolith. You often read descriptions of perry in a very generalized sense as just being something that is light and floral and mostly a bit sweet. And often it is. And those perries can be lovely, but it's so much more than that. You know, you taste something like the flaky bark from Ross on Wye, and it is big and muscular and bold and tannic and rich. Or you taste an ice perry, so a dessert perry that's luscious and honeyed. Or you taste an Austrian Birnenmost that is very much influenced by the white wines of that region, and it's fresh and brisk and vinous in texture and dry and sharp and beautiful with the local food. Or you taste something like a Mistel, which is a fortified pear juice, and they're very popular in the Domfront region of France. So it's the same idea as a pomo, which is the equivalent made from apples, but it's made from pear spirit added to pear must. And those are oak-aged, and they're bold, and they're rich. So perry has this huge, huge diversity of style and flavour, and of course, that's augmented by the fact that there are hundreds of perry pear varieties, culinary pear varieties that are used to make perry all over the world, and each one of those varieties offers different flavours, either on its own or as part of a blend. So people should look out perry, because it is so much more than perhaps they might believe it to be, and there is a world of flavour for the curious drinker to uncover.
If I'm listening to this and I haven't had an opportunity to sort of get into perry and I'm not certain where to start, where would be the best place for me to look to get my sort of first taste of perry?
First and foremost, look up camera recommended pubs such as your own, Alison, the Hop Inn. If there isn't one within immediate walking distance, one of the great things that's happened within cider and perry, and what's facilitated, in my opinion, this revolution that we've seen in the last 5 years, is the rise of online cider and perry merchants. Originally Scratting's, who are much missed, but also the Fine Cider Company, and particularly the Cat in the Glass, that's run by Nikki Kong. And they have an incredible selection of perries from a broad array of producers, which are home delivery. So that has really moved the gateposts on accessibility to perry, where previously you maybe had to know of producers and go to these places, usually in Herefordshire or Gloucestershire or Monmouthshire. You know, now you can find this selection online and order mixed cases or cases of your favourite to your home. And they're run by such knowledgeable people that if you're not sure, if you're bewildered by this choice, the descriptions are there, but you can also just reach out and contact them and say, here are my preferences, here are things I've enjoyed maybe in the past, here are flavours that I like, what can you recommend? And they always will. They do a fantastic job.
Just to recap, you mentioned in October you will be having a Kickstarter or a process there. And what type of thing is going to be going on around that?
We're still working out the details of exactly how the Kickstarter will go, but it's coinciding with what's usually Camera's Cider Month, but is this year going to be Camera's Perry Month. So there'll be videos and tastings and events and all sorts of things going on that we'll be very much involved with. Regarding the Kickstarter, again, we're figuring out the shape it's going to take, but there'll be things like signing up for potentially early copies of the book, or some other tastings, or whatever else it might be. So we're going to come up with some really sort of exciting stuff, which I'm very much looking forward to.
Thank you so much, and thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So there we are. A big thank you to the Camera team for making all of this possible. To my fellow hosts, Claire Phillips and Simon Webster, and our chief editor, David King. We'd like to dedicate this episode to Camera GBBF's incredible volunteers, well over 1,000 of them, as well as our hardworking volunteers at festivals all over the country.
And that's it until the next season of Pubs, Pints, People. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, give us a like, and you can also find full details of this and past episodes on the Camera website at camera.org.uk/podcast. And of course, you can find us on our social media channels as well.
Does a free case of beer sound?
Yes, you can grab a case for free courtesy of our pals at Beer 52 by going to www.beer52.com. beer52.com/people, that's the numbers 52 in the 52, and covering the meagre postage cost of £5.95. And what's more, as a special offer for our listeners, they'll throw in 2 extra beers for free, so that's 10 unique craft beers.
Beer 52 is actually the biggest beer club in the world. Each month, they send their members a case of beer from a different part of the world, and this month it's an absolute belter. Their great European road trip case takes in the best beers from across the continent.
So try a crisp, refreshing Pilsner from Norway's Lervig Brewery and a monster 7.5 double IPA from Sweden's Durges Brewery. On the dark side this month, there's a smooth stout from Copenhagen's Tuol. There's also beer from Croatia, Poland, Germany, Serbia and Austria, among others.
And if dark beer's not your thing, you can choose the light-only case. Also included is the ever-insightful Ferment magazine and a couple of tasty snacks. And even if, after all that, you're still unsatisfied, you can simply pause or cancel at any time.
So head over to www.beer52, that's the numbers 5 and 2, .com/people to claim your free case of 10 beers now.